May we hear the reading of God's word today from Luke, the 11th chapter, verses 24 through 26. When the unclean spirit has gone out of the man, he passes through waterless places seeking rest. And finding none, he says, I will return to my house from which I came. And when he comes, he finds it swept and put in order. Then he goes and brings seven other spirits, more evil than himself, and they enter and dwell there. And the last state of that man becomes worse than the first.
If you'd mind shifting now down into first, then at the end we'll go back into fourth. Maybe I can give a theological basis for exactly what we're doing this morning, because I do think there's a relationship between what I want to say and what we've been doing. When I was in high school and living in Richmond, Virginia, my family moved to the far suburbs. It was a beautiful new home, its most attractive feature being a tree-studded lot which merged in the backyard into a beautiful wooded hollow. We were fully aware that the seclusion of our new home site would be short-lived. The city was moving in our direction and inevitably would take the lot that adjoined our lot, its precious old trees, its wildflowers, its creek, everything. Sure enough, sooner than we had expected, the bulldozers moved in. Down went all the trees, the shrubs, the undergrowth. The slopes were leveled out, the creek bed was filled in, the old natural lines of the hollow were completely obliterated, and in its place appeared a perfectly flat plot, without growth of any sort, just waiting for some fancy new suburban homes with their hothouse landscaping. Man had subdued nature, and as a triumphal monument, or perhaps as an epitaph, a large sign was shoved into the newly moved dirt, "Lots for sale." Nature, however, had the final word, and that swiftly, before even the first lot had been sold. With a vengeance, as if in retaliation, the rains came and the floods descended. A freak configuration of air currents trapped some heavy rain clouds over a tiny segment of Richmond where we lived. The flash flood that followed brought in 2 hours 8 inches of rain. The result was unbelievable. The River Road Bridge was washed out. The coal supply at the University of Richmond wound up in the middle of the James River. A number of roads were absolutely impassable, but nowhere was the destruction more evident than in that construction project behind our house. The water from the surrounding hills found its way quite naturally to the landfill where the creek bed had once been. This time there were no contours of land to break its force of descent, no tree roots, no undergrowth, no accumulation of leaves to lessen the flood tides. Instead, the newly moved soil, now weighed under by the heavy measure of rain, pressed down like a concrete highway, and the water roared on. In the end, all man's work was completely wiped out. The newly smoothed lots were gone. And in their place, a series of ugly gullies appeared where they had once stood. The creek bed once more appeared, but instead of its gently sloping banks, there now was a veritable gorge. Where had the developers failed? They had certainly leveled the land beautifully. They had produced some most attractive lots. They failed precisely because they did not take the lay of the land nor its natural drainage patterns into consideration. In short, they had merely cleaned the lot, made it attractive, where they should have put in culverts, new patterns of drainage. This they had not done, and the severe consequences followed. As home lots, you might say the end product was about 10 times worse than the original hollow that once stood there. This is very much akin to Jesus' parable about the unfurnished house. It is a grisly little story about an unclean spirit which had been ejected from a man's life. The demon wanders about in the desert, which was the natural abode of the demons in first century Jewish thought. But he is unhappy with his homelessness, having no one to work his mischief on. So he returns to his former home, and there everything is in perfect order, neat, clean, well swept. In fact, now it is suitable for far more than his own needs, so he shares his joy. He goes out and finds seven demons worse than himself and brings them back as his roommates. Jesus' summary is almost an understatement. The worst state of that man, the last state of that man becomes worse than the first. Yes, indeed, seven times worse. What was the original setting of this parable? Jeremias classifies it as belonging to those whose theme is the challenge of the hour. In Luke, it follows Jesus' debate with the Pharisees over his authority to cast out demons. Perhaps its original setting was an actual demon exorcism. The parable would then have served as a warning to the healed person, a warning that the mere absence of the demon from his life would not ultimately solve his problem, that he must now become positively oriented to God's kingdom and put something better in the place of the void that now existed. In any event, the point of the parable is simple. Merely to clean house is not enough. In fact, to merely clean house can be exceedingly dangerous. One doesn't have to labor to find an application to this parable. It speaks to every sort of negativism in religion. To the context of religious experience, it says that conversion must be genuine, not just a turning from the old, but a positive orientation to the new, which makes the old no longer even desirable. To the context of Christian morality, it strikes at the very heart of that sort of Puritan ethic which majors in the don'ts and maintains that true Christianity exists in avoiding the pitfalls and resisting temptation. Instead, it calls for that dynamic orientation to Christ, which Paul calls walking by the Spirit, which is a genuine situation ethic in the best sense of that word. Likewise, and perhaps most directly, the parable has something to say to pastoral counseling. Namely, that ridding one of his symptoms, casting out the demon, isn't a full cure. It won't ensure the non-return of the problem, indeed a worsening of the problem, unless the person is given a positive new orientation, a new principle in life, a new hope, a new relationship to Christ and his kingdom. But the application I'd like to make this morning is a little more general still. It is simply that an attitude of negativism is a perilous matter. The parable speaks in a real sense to the hypercritical spirits of our times. Times in which no idea, no structure of past or present is uncritically accepted. Everything is challenged in government, in education, in business, in family life, yes, in the church. This spirit finds its caricature in those radical groups of the fringe, the yippies, the weathermen, the Jerry Rubins, who make no pretense of offering any real solution to the ills of our times, whose one avowed purpose is to wipe out the whole mess. The church is never really sheltered from the zeitgeist, and today she is experiencing the most searching challenge of her structures and traditions that this century has yet witnessed. Many outside the church, especially among the college generation, have rejected her as utterly useless, irrelevant to, and incapable of solving the real problems of our times. Within the church, the voices of young and old alike challenge her every assumption, her programs, her message, her motives, her lines of authority. In our Southern Baptist life, there has been no immunity from such scrutiny, despite our entrenched isolationism. We have been impugned for our sanctification of provincial patterns of prejudice, Many are disillusioned with the Madison Avenue structure of our church programs. Others feel that its mission, that in our mission, the church has cast her eyes far too much on the distant shore and failed to look at her own back door. Still others point an accusing finger at the ills of our revival tradition. Its evangelists of personality cult stripe, its coercive and manipulative techniques, its stress on numbers rather than persons, its failure often to adequately carry through. Now, all these are valid criticisms, these and many more. And I have often raised the voice of protest myself. But what I want to stress this morning is that such criticism by itself can be perilous, destructive. Yes, mere criticism is insufficient for true renewal, insufficient because purely negative. In short, we all constantly run the danger of seeking to merely clean house, to exorcise the demons without replacing them. This is a real problem in an institution like our seminary, where we are constantly undergoing a process of self-examination. The point is, however, that if that criticism is not positive, does not offer something better in place of the old, it is ultimately a disservice to the Lord's work. I fear with all this attitude of critical scrutiny, we actually convey a rather negative posture to much of our constituency. We appear to be always attacking, never building up. Sometimes we refuse to take part altogether in the programs of the church because we disagree with some of its procedures. We communicate all the doubts and gripes and none of the hopes. We get lost almost unconsciously in a spirit of negativism which appears to many to be a lack of conviction, a failure in commitment. We are too busy exorcising the demons. We do not fill the void their absence creates. Now, lest in all this I be indicted for propounding a reactionary agnosticism, let me reiterate the major implications of the parable as I see them. The implicit presupposition of this parable is that critique must take place. The demons had to be cast out of these people's lives or they were lost. You had to start with that. Critique is essential. The church needs a clean house. The main brunt of the parable, however, is that mere house cleaning is not enough. By far the more excellent way, then, is a posture of positive commitment to our Lord and the work of His kingdom, to exude radiant personal conviction in the purposes and goals of that kingdom work. In such a way, the positive approach, the real critique will follow not through the vomit of a nauseous negative spirit, but through the superiority of a better way, through the natural mirror of the truth. Not that resistance won't be met. It will. In the gospel stories of the demon exorcisms, I don't think the demons particularly relished being exorcised. But if our dedication to Christ is real, He who exorcised them once will not fail to do so now through us. In the Civilization series currently being carried on local television, Sir Kenneth Clark explained that the Dark Ages were brought on not so much by the direct, willful destruction of the Roman institutions by the barbarian hordes, but by the much more devastating phenomenon of their total rejection of its values and all the aspirations of the human spirit that it represented. In short, by the extreme negativism of the barbarian mindset. Now, that is the danger we incur in our critique of the church. The danger of descending goth-like and snuffing out all light in our path. But it is also our challenge, the challenge of the hour, for new commitment, for that positive renewal which exorcises the old demons and replaces them by the true principle of the Christian life, Jesus Christ and His kingdom.